We'll start, as we always do, by taking a look at the Sunday newspapers, and our panel in studio this morning to help me do that is Mick Clifford, author and special correspondent with the Irish Examiner. Good morning, Mick. How are you?
Morning, Gavin.
Richie Oakley is the editor of the Ireland edition of The Times. Richie, good morning to you. Happy
morning.
Easter. And Lindsay Erner-Byrne is associate professor at the School of History at UCD. Good morning, Lindsay.
Morning.
And thank you all very much for coming in. A quick tour of the front pages of the Sunday newspapers this morning. And start with the Sunday Independent. Alarm at the cost of 7 week paid parental leave, reports Philip Ryan. He says cabinet ministers have raised serious concerns over the government's plan to give thousands of new parents 7 weeks paid parental leave, the Sunday Independent can reveal. Senior ministers issued stark warnings to colleagues about the impact that the landmark legislation would have on businesses and schools ahead of a private cabinet meeting last week. Joe McHugh, it says, is among the several ministers warning that their departments would not be able to cover the financial costs arising from the introduction of 7 weeks paid parental leave. A top story in the Sunday Independent, just above the fold. Second CEO gave a 100k sports loan to a sports association. It reports that the Cricket Ireland chief executive Warren Guthrum gave his organisation a CEO loan of €100,000 last year. It seems to have been paid last October so that staff and some creditors could be paid. The loan was repaid on December 7th last year. And just point out that there's no suggestion of wrongdoing on Warren Guthrum's part, but it is a similar financial predicament that Cricket Ireland found itself in, that the FAI found itself in 2017. And look where that has gone, because on the front page of the Sunday Times, for what I think is the fifth week running, possibly even the sixth week, Mark Tighe has more details about the finances of the FAI. He reports that John Delaney issued an instruction to the FAI's finance department to pay his then-girlfriend €15,000 in 2014, according to internal records seen by the Sunday Times. The FAI's SAGE accountancy term programme records a total of €60,000 in, quote, professional fee payments in the name of Susan Keegan in late 2013 and early 2014, at a time when she was the chief executive's girlfriend. Neither Delaney, who has been on gardening leave since last Monday, nor the FAI have offered an explanation as to what the payments were for. The FAI said that an independent investigation by the association into issues of concern on the board is continuing and further comment would not be possible at its time. Two main stories there also around the fold. Sarah Rally sparks outrage on social media. This is a story about that march yesterday by the self-styled Republican group Sarah, who held a march replete with paramilitary garb on the capital city's main street, O'Connell Street, yesterday, and some of the distaste there is to that. And also on the front page, Michael Ring, the Minister for Rural Affairs, has challenged RTE to reveal the salary and expenses paid to Pat Spillane over the past 25 years after the former Kerry footballer used an appearance on The Late Late Show to criticise his dismissal from a government role. No doubt Kerry football aficionado Mick Clifford will have something to say about that in a couple of minutes' time. We'll move on. Front page of the Sunday Business Post. Exclusive leaked files reveal fresh problems for the Children's Hospital. Dire warnings from the outgoing project director in documents sent to the Department of Health. Hugh O'Connell has this story. He says the National Children's Hospital project is facing a risk of further cost claims from contractors, a scarcity of construction workers and staff resignations. Leaked government documents reveal. Department of Health documents seen by the Business Post reveal that the outgoing project director, John Pollock, believes it will be extremely difficult to find a successor. He of course reports that the cost of the troubled hospital project has risen to $1.4 billion. It's expected to exceed $2 billion before the hospital opens in 2023. The new project director is also being warned about contractor behaviour and further cost claims in the coming years. So that's all going very well. Only really one story that's dominating a lot of the tabloids, and that is the events on O'Connell Street yesterday. The front page of the Sunday World simply says, disgusting. Dissident Republicans showed their contempt for the outpouring of grief at the murder of journalist Lyra McKee by marching through Dublin in full military gear yesterday. They paraded from the Garden of Remembrance before holding a rally at the GPO while dressed in camouflage combat jackets, mirror sunglasses and berets. Front page of the Irish Sunday Mirror. The political wing of the new IRA marched outside the GPO in Dublin yesterday, less than 48 hours after journalist Lyra McKee was murdered. In a show of defiance, up to 150 men and women in military fatigues took over the capital's busiest street. And the front page of the Irish Mail on Sunday, outrage over, inverted commas, apology for Lyra's murder. Politicians and friends of new IRA murder victim Lyra McKee have expressed outrage after the terror group's political wing marched past the GPO and offered a cynical apology to her heartbroken family. It says the dissident Republican group Sarah, whose banners proclaim that there is an unfinished revolution, held a military parade up and down O'Connell Street in Dublin yesterday, which was described as a celebration of murder by one horrified protester who witnessed it. And that story is indeed all over today's papers. I'll start actually by just going around the table. Mick, I'll start with you. Is there anything in particular that strikes you about the coverage of Lear McKee in today's papers?
Yeah, Gene Kerrigan has a very good column on it. Out of the darkness, a shot from the past. He says, in the troubled journalism business, a talented woman was doing her job when the old fantasies took her life. And I think that really sums it up very well. Anybody getting murdered is a horrendous episode, particularly when it's cloaked in some form of political views. But particularly, and this is, I'm speaking as a journalist myself, but anybody whose role might be regarded as being in some form involving one of the pillars of democracies, whether it be a journalist, a police person, anybody like that, I think that adds an extra element to the whole thing. And you put on top of that the individual herself, Lyra McKee, where she came from, the way she spoke out for minorities, her representation of the LGBT community. I mean, the whole thing, it really is... People are saying it's a watershed moment. We'll just have to wait and see.
What do you make of the demonstration yesterday by Sarah, as her reply described in some of the papers as the political wing of the new IRA, and the fact that they seemed very belated to issue any sort of a condemnation or criticism of the bullet that killed Lyra McKee?
Well, it just shows the same contempt that has been there always for any type of democratic process. I mean, things are more complicated than that. I mean, for instance, those who would formerly have been in the so-called provisional movement get on a certain high moral ground, but the type of stuff that's being peddled by the dissidents now was for 25, 30 years being peddled by the so-called provisional movement. You know, but in terms of pure contempt for the democracy, I think that's very evident from it. However, things need to be put in a context. This type of organisation is at its head. You have what you might call old IRA people, as in those who go back to the days of the trouble and what have you. But the really worrying element is the ability to recruit young people into it, and the context in which that is done in terms of the wider political movement, including everything, including Brexit.
Well, in talking about younger people, Lindsay, this is a point that I wanted to come to you on yesterday, because the one thing that I was struck by, obviously we heard the ages of some of the people that were arrested in connection with Lear McKee's murder on Thursday night, Friday morning. But one thing that struck me in the footage of the Sarah march down O'Connell Street yesterday was that there were a great number of people wearing those military fatigues who were quite demonstrably very young, who appeared to have, much as the people in Derry who are getting involved in violence now, that they appear to have not very much recollection or understanding of the path this country has come down and the, albeit fragile, but the sort of constitutional peace that we have at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, Alison Morris has a piece, I think, in the Sunday Business Post, and she talks about these young people being corrupted by a romanticised version of militant republicanism. I suppose it's a sort of misuse of history, or the way in which, precisely because they don't have a memory, that can be romanticised. But what struck me about the story, and it really is further reflected in all of the papers today, is how it is, in a sense, well, it has really local Irish dimensions to it, and particularly Northern Irish dimensions to it. It is, in a sense, a microcosm of what's happening worldwide. So you've got this kind of vacuum in the north politically, where there are sections of the community that don't feel represented. There isn't a government. You also have acute areas of social deprivation, which are of course then ripe for this kind of, if you like, grooming or indoctrination. And then you have this rise of a really simplistic form of nationalism, which is happening worldwide. You can see all of that in the tragic events in Derry this week.
Richie Oakley, sometimes, although we would all like for there to be functioning proper democracy and a devolved assembly and everything working in Northern Ireland as its settlement decrees that it should be, but sometimes I wonder whether, in the rush to say, well, this mightn't have happened if we had a functioning Stormont or if there wasn't this total vacuum up there, you know, dissident Republicans aren't going to stop being dissident or aren't going to stop taking up arms just because there is an assembly that they don't want to have anything to do with. So sometimes I wonder if we just play Stormont as the get out of jail card and we just say, oh, this wouldn't be happening if Northern Ireland was properly functioning, when I suspect reality, the conflicts and the divisions there run a little bit more deeply than that.
Well, I think if you have a normal Stormont and you have a government in place and you have decisions being made that affect people's lives, the moment they can't even decide on infrastructure projects in the north, there was a big legal wrangle over whether or not the civil servants could make decisions in the absence of ministers, and that's still being played out. So there's big key projects being held up that do have an impact on people's lives. And you could argue that you have to have even if you had normalcy, these people would still exist. I think it gives these people more of an opportunity to recruit young people without a political vacuum. And just, I mean, there's a great piece, Brendan O'Connor and Michael McDougall do a piece where they talk about the political responsibility. For me, it was really interesting to see Arlene Foster there, you know, making comments on this murder when Liam McKee stood for loads of things that the DUP are actually blocking coming into effect. In terms
of social reforms and
And Sinn Féin, you had Mary Lou MacDonald as well, and Sinn Féin would, you know, commemorate violent IRA incidents in the past. And again, that didn't seem to be something Liam McKee would stand for as an objective, hardworking, independent-minded journalist. So in that context, I think politics in Northern Ireland needs to move on, and it needs to move on quickly. But, you know, the signs of that happening, I mean, there's so long now without a government, and you can keep saying, you know, even just in terms of the amount of upheaval Brexit has created, they need a government in place in Northern Ireland to deal with that. Michael McDougall excoriates both Sinn Féin and the DUP in a really good column in the Business Post, where he just kind of talks about how they're not living up to their responsibilities as political parties, and they're not serving the people in the North either. And he says that the people in the North will eventually come around to this and move their votes elsewhere if they had that option, I think is the key thing to say there.
I suppose it is a reminder, Lindsay, that in some sense, although we've had relative peace for 21 years, and of course this is Easter weekend, it's the 21st anniversary of Good Friday being agreed by all the parties that were participants in the talks at the time, but it is a reminder that having constitutional peace doesn't necessarily mean that all of the sentiments clearly go away, or that people don't change what's in their hearts overnight, and that there is going to be this lingering subbed of subversism.
Oh yeah, of course. And I think anybody that thought that wasn't the case was very naive. I mean, even in the last 20 years, we've had kind of pepperings of violence. But I do think that Brexit is creating this environment that gives us a perfect storm, where the North is sort of almost isolated. All the political attention is gone to Westminster and Brexit. And the two big parties, that is the DUP, it suits them very much to focus on Westminster. And Sinn Féin is busy creating the narrative that possibly now is the time for United Ireland. So in a sense, the two big parties that should be doing something about that have an interest, in a sense, in the situation.
Yeah, I think an element to that was the way it has evolved over 20 years. Mm. The main drivers of the peace process, to a large extent, were the moderates on both sides, the SDLP and the Ulster Unionist Party. People have retreated to the extremes in both communities, and those are the parties now driving the agenda, and they are very politically minded in terms of maintaining their own support rather than the general.
I'm sure both parties would object to that, but specifically Sinn Féin would object to the idea of them being labelled that they're slightly on the more extreme wing of republicanism. They would regard themselves as quite moderate by the present day.
Well, until 20 years ago, they were in favour of killing people for republicanism. So, and I mean, you know,
and of course, they would dispute that too. But
they would, but I mean, they're are suggestions that they're not what you might call fully constitutional. I don't know whether or not that's the case, but one way or the other, there's no doubt that the general thrust of politics over 20 years has moved away from the centre, and that feeds in to the type of environment that Lindsay was making the point about that is global now. It feeds far more into that type of an environment, and as we see, there's no government there. The whole thing that adds to the vacuum, and it just... It's inevitable something like this is going to spill over at some stage.
That said, though, Liran herself embodied all that has...
Absolutely.
I think we shouldn't get carried away and it'll be negative. I think it's only natural this week that we are. But I was really struck by the amount of people when they did Vox Pops on the various stations, how many people were feeling, you know, things have changed, things have got better. On the ground, things are better for many, many people.
But not in the more deprived areas, which is where it'd be most acutely felt.
Yes, and which Lira ironically tried to articulate and give voice to, which is the real tragedy there in some senses. And I thought what was really great about Gene Kerrigan's piece was he linked it to, again, the broader issue facing journalism and therefore all of us, if that sort of traditional investigative journalism is stripped of resources and finances and sort of difficulty we're in, because you could see the difference between the responses on things like Twitter versus mainstream media and how there's no analysis and there's a complete negativity surrounding a lot of the accounts, and it's very, very polarised on Twitter. And I think that was really interesting about Gene Kerrigan's piece. But
I think the interesting thing about this, Richie, is Sauerkraut being the political wing of the new IRA. You know, there's local elections going on, there's European elections. Where are their candidates in those? If they're going to be marching down O'Connell Street, surely they should be marching around knocking on Irish doors.
I'm not even sure, at least on this side of the border, I'm not even sure they're a registered political party.
Yeah, so exactly. So, I mean, that's the key thing, because in general, Irish people don't have an appetite for that type of extremes. And these guys are living in the past.
Yeah, they had minders as well. Did you see that? So anybody who tried to ask some questions was told to get lost.
Yeah, which I see a point being made by some people on Twitter this morning, making the point that if you have the freedom to march down a street and the other people also have the freedom to march on the same street, that you have the freedom to engage or disengage with each other, but you shouldn't be trying to cut off questions simply because you're not of a mood.
Absolutely extraordinary.
It is, I think an awful lot of it still comes back to how the post-conflict environment has been neglected in some aspects, and that's where you have the potential to recruit disaffected young people in the more disadvantaged areas, and that's what's particularly the nationalist areas, but different in a different context in some of the loyalist areas.
On the point of neglect, and I think you're right to say that obviously it's the fact that, you know, it was barely 30 hours after the death of Lira McKee that of course it's going to attract more attention, but Sarah have been having these marches at Easter weekend on both sides of the border on a 32 county basis for a couple of years now, and generally speaking people don't pay the blindest bit of heed to them. So is there a danger that by virtue of all rushing to condemn judgment to say that their march yesterday was in poor taste, that you actually only end up, you know, pouring fuel on the fire here?
Possibly, but I mean, what more interesting I think is how representative is that march? I mean, you can go out there and get some kind of an organisation and declare yourself to be a national body and march down the street, and is it representative of anything? I just wonder, you know. I mean, there's no doubt in the areas like the Craigan there, they have managed to have some sort of a foothold in some elements of it, but you just wonder how representative that is of anything beyond some of those areas.
Lindsay, how do we balance the fact that this was yesterday's march down O'Connell Street, it was a march that was intended to gather fewer than 500 people, and therefore there was no need for those people to seek or to access a permit in order for their march. So they enjoy, whether we might share their goals or not, these people enjoy the same civil liberties as the rest of us to gather and to, you know, display and to commemorate. How do we strike some sort of balance between allowing those people their own Republican freedoms of assembly and demonstration and commemoration, while the rest of us equally have the right to say that what they're doing is in terrible taste?
Well, that's the real quandary that we're in lots of issues, in the sense of what's the boundary between freedom of speech and incitement of hatred or enabling dangerous organisations. And there was nothing stopping people confronting the people on the streets yesterday and asking them questions. It was just some self-elected minder that tried to prevent that. It is a real difficulty because that's where we're very vulnerable in democratic countries, because we have to protect those rights. They're not passive rights, the rights to freedom of speech and so on. On the other hand, you can see that classically with Brexit, when you sort of enable people like Farage, who seemed initially, the UKIP people seemed initially exactly as Sarah might seem to many now, as completely ludicrous and fringe. And then suddenly they're kind of propelled into mainstream and contribute to possibly one of the greatest political upheavals in the 21st century. Who knows what's come later? But I think that's the essential difficulty we have, and I don't have an answer for it. I think we're constantly balancing.
But another parallel there, Richie, again, when people might invoke the example of Nigel Farage, that was a fire to which more fuel was gathered by the oxygen of publicity, and there may well be the danger that by having Sarah on the front page of newspapers, albeit for some of the reasons that they might not appreciate, but that suddenly they're getting an awful lot more media coverage where previously they might not.
I don't know. My experience of Ireland is that we're slightly more mature democracy, maybe because of our small size. I think in the UK there's a massive disconnect between political decisions and the general public. I think in Ireland, where people slag off the media here, but we're reasonably well served media terms, I think people understand a lot of the decisions that are being made and are more connected to political groups and things. So I think the average person sitting at home watching this isn't going to see a picture of Sarah on the front page and say, I'm dusting down my army fatigues and my Ray-Ban sunglasses and heading out onto O'Connell Street to march along these sides. I think the majority of people looking at that would just say, you know, these guys do not represent me. I think in Ireland, we can discuss issues. You know, this idea of say immigration as an issue. I'm perfectly happy to think that in Ireland, we can discuss that from a credible position without, giving more power to extreme elements. I think we're slightly mature on
the basis of what
sense.
Happened. On the basis of what happened there, you'd have to mark that march yesterday, and of course it's distasteful, but you do have to be very careful in terms of civil liberties. And what everyone says about Farage, and yes, it is true to a large extent, he still got the votes, and that is the unfortunate reality. Pardon?
How did they get them?
Well, he gets them for manipulating,
yeah,
utter
and
manipulation.
Illegal spending and so
absolutely,
on, which is
yeah,
being
yeah,
found
but
in
I'm
court.
But I'm only making the point.
Yeah.
Shutting down people and is another extreme that I think, again, that is as much an assault on democracy as anything.
And we're constantly
people manipulating
balanced.
It.
Yeah,
we have to
balanced.
Constantly
got to inform,
Trump is another obvious example.
Yeah.
Let it be known, by the way, that outside the GPO right now, the sole and legitimate defence forces of this country are having their annual demonstration for Easter Sunday, and long may they be the only legitimate armed forces that are ruling the roost around here. With memory of all of those who are loved and who have come across Lira McKee, we're thinking of them all this morning. It's been a very, very difficult time for them. This is On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk. More after the break on what's going on in Derry, and also the report this week into mother and baby homes, which really in any other week will be getting much more coverage than it does. Back after this.
I was the man who led that report. I was the man who delivered that report to the minister. And indirectly, thanks to me, Minister Ring got a minister. And I was the first fella to be shafted. You couldn't make it up.
Yeah.
Whether it's true or not, he certainly couldn't make it up. Anyway, that's Pat Bilan speaking on the Late Late Show on Friday night. Michael Ring has kicked back in some of the papers this morning, and we'll talk about that in the next part here to come on News Talks On The Record. We're going through the papers this morning with Mick Clifford, Lindsay Erner-Byrne and Richie Oakley. There is some content today, as I mentioned before the break, about the fifth interim report of the Commission of Investigation into Mother and Baby Homes. Selene Byrne has a piece in the Sunday Business Post, and there's also a full page in the Sunday Independent with pieces by Maeve Sheehy and Ralph Regal, and indeed Kira Kelly of this parish as well. The one thing that strikes me though, Lindsay, as I said, is that in any other week we would surely be overrun with fully justified coverage in the Sunday papers about the systematic deaths of hundreds of infants, if not thousands of infants, in various places across the country, and a report which seems to come dramatically short in terms of answers as to how they ended up where they did.
It's a very revealing report though. If you read it, I think the whole dynamics of the story are in those 90 some pages, because essentially if you read it, and they repeat it several times in the report, the commission has been frustrated despite doing extensive research, so cross-referencing like hundreds of documents that are available. They essentially, in the case, I think it's Bessborough, of 900 children, can identify the burial of 64, and what they are reporting is systematic failure to record. In the case of the county council's legal requirement to record where burials took place, and in the case of some of the religious orders, canon requirement, and at the very least a moral requirement to do so, and it wasn't done. But also I found there very interesting that they end the report on a wider reflection of society's resistance.
Just
now,
for people who aren't too fully up to speed with what exactly the report said, what was that reflection, or can you kind of summarise it for
effectively
us?
It reflects that this is a story that involves all of Irish society, which collectively on various levels looked away as these homes dealt with mothers who had either children outside marriage, there's various other reasons why women may have ended up in there, but that the babies' death rates were inordinately high, much higher than the death rate for babies outside those institutions. And this particular report was investigating, prompted very much by the Tume controversy, where were these babies buried? What were the burial practices? How were they recorded, etc.? And it has essentially come up with a lack of documentation, either it's gone missing, but in many cases, for example, in the case of Galway County Council, it appears, which would have been connected
responsible to Tume,
it appears that they were never recorded in the first place, but also Cork County Council, the Finbar home is the same. And then many of the bodies of babies were also given to the universities for anatomical research. And again, in a lot of cases, proper paperwork wasn't carried out. Now, they do specify that the universities have been cooperating and trying to assist relatives since 2011, but they're pretty damning in relation to the county council and also to some of the religious orders. I think what really struck me, the story Bessborough is the story for me,
yes,
in the report,
yeah.
Where you've got huge numbers of babies and really no idea of where they were buried or what those practices were, which is extraordinary given the numbers that went through that home.
I will bring in Mick and Richie in just a moment, but just on Bessborough, there was this one finding that the commission, despite its efforts, wasn't able to find a conclusive burial place for so many of those children. And one thing that immediately jumped out, certainly in terms of the social media reaction, that people pointed out that if you go back to maps from the 1930s, Ordnance Survey maps of the time, and even the Air Code Finder map as of today. If you go to the former site of the Bessborough Mother and Baby Home, that marked very clearly on the map is an area that's marked as children's burial ground, and it's quite clearly demarcated from the cemetery that the nuns who were occupied in that home were buried in, that it's quite clear that there was a children's burial ground there. So can you surmise as to why the commission said that it wasn't able to find conclusive evidence in many of these cases when there is a clearly demarcated children's burial ground?
They deal with that burial ground and that marking, and it's also a very, very, it's a huge site, Bessborough. So they talk about not being able to do testing of all those grounds, but they believe that that burial area is simply not big enough, and that there's not the evidence that that's where those children were buried.
So there's a massive imbalance between the number of children who are recorded as dying and the number of children whose remains they can find.
Yeah, and they talk about the Congregation of the Sacred Heart of Jesus and Mary, who owned and ran these institutions, in this case Bessborough, or Castle Pollard and Sean Ross Abbey, actually giving affidavits that were speculative and accurate or misleading. But they are, in the case of Bessborough and the other homes, they do express surprise that nobody has any memory. And not the nuns or not anybody in the local area, given the long period of span. You know, they're talking about from the 1920s, mid-20s, late 30s, up to the 70s, in some cases the 1990s, that these homes operated. So they do go into detail. They do discuss that the location on the map for that burial,
okay.
But they don't have evidence that that was used. You're talking about, I think in the case of Bessborough, I think it's 900 babies that you're talking about. In 64, they can say they know where the burials were. And so they do go through all those, and they do talk about the methods they use, and they use various different methods, including in tomb soil analysis. And they do say that in relation to tomb, there's evidence that babies were buried inside a structure that was inside the septic tank.
There is a danger that we can get very dispassionate and clinical in terms of the language that we use here. And I suppose you have to remember that this was prompted by, you know, a massive human horror of things that we might have known about, but that things that are, which really ought not to be just glossed over or treated as just a historical fact, that they still should be seen as the atrocities, I suppose, that they were. Richie, is there anything in this morning's coverage of the topic that jumps out for you?
Yeah, Elaine Byrne's piece is very good, where she kind of talks about a poisoned Irish silence, and the fact that the tragedy is that people who know things or who potentially know things have not come forward, which was obviously something that the report picked up on. And she goes through the various things that like, you know, a report like this is going, you know, the commission's running for 4 years. It's supposed to find facts, but what it has found is a lot of stuff of what we don't know. And then Michael Brennan has a piece in the Business Post as well about Fianna Fáil kind of saying that the amount of money that it's going to cost to do the full excavation of bodies and things in Tuam, that Fianna Fáil are saying that this money could be better spent on homeless children today. And I suppose that's the conundrum here is what's the cost of discovering the full truth in relation to this, but then also what is the actual cost of not doing so?
Yeah, and that's the thing that I think is very striking, because, I mean, we even had the same debate, we won't get into it now, but we had the same debate during the week about Notre Dame and whether the money that would go towards, you know, the human heritage of there should be better spent on modern day concerns as well. You do come across one point, though, that I want to put to you, Mick, that ultimately this is a commission of investigation, and at least in theory, what a commission of investigation should be doing is discovering things to which there was no clear, conclusive answer before. But it seems that up till now, the Commission of Investigation, while it's doing very worthy work, it hasn't necessarily uncovered things that weren't already, they might have slipped from the public mind, but they were certainly on the public record. Like, for example, Lindsay mentioned the mortality rates in some of those probes. I remember going back through the Dáil Library and finding reports that showed that there was a demonstrable difference in the mortality rates between those homes and regular maternity hospitals, going back to the 1920s and 30s.
But an awful lot of that is, I think, and you can trace that right up to the most recent years in terms of ignoring what's in plain sight. Apart from the initial crimes that were committed against these women and children, you have a scenario whereby in the 70s, for example, in Tuam, they were building housing estates, and the commission finds it difficult to believe that the county council did not become aware of the situation there, that what was involved in these in this burial ground, effectively. But take it even more recently. Catherine Corliss was at this for years. Conal O'Flaherty and the Irish Examiner
Absolutely.
Was writing about this.
And deserves a lot of credit
and
for that.
And still is, yeah.
And still is. And yet, they were at that for years before it was finally seeping through and being recognised. And so much of it has to do with people not wanting to acknowledge the truth. I mean, speak to an older generation, they'll talk about the high walls of the laundries, etc., and even when they were kids, and going past it and being told, well, that's what goes on in there. And
yeah, Justine McCarthy has a good piece on that. She lived near the one in Cork.
Yeah, yeah. It was hidden in plain sight from everybody. So, I mean, the point Lindsay was making about the conclusion of the report, I think, is extremely valid in the whole
thing.
And
to be honest, even when you did, because, I mean, I did my PhD on it, so, and I published a book on it in 2007, in which I record the death rates in all of these homes, and reviewers of that book never mentioned that section.
Yeah.
So these were would have been really informed people who knew the history of the period. So they were much more interested in the bits I had on McQuaid and mother and baby scheme and all the things. But they were not as interested in the section on mother and baby. They were not horrified.
Why do you think that is?
Whether it is that people had to have this almost reflected back to them to see how grotesque it was, I don't know the answer, because I was horrified.
Very often with stories like that, there has to be some dramatic development before it can be finally acknowledged.
That was the dynamics of Tuam. And again, remember that the Tuam story came out twice. So it came out once and was not really picked up domestically. Mm. And about 18 months, 2 years later, I can't remember the time frame, it came out a second time, but that this time from international media. And then it was picked up.
So that has precedence.
And there is a moment in time as well in a culture when people are ready to hear things.
Absolutely. You know, one other quick thing just in relation
to it. Please, yeah.
Colin was making this point in the Irish Examiner. They're looking at how the baby's bodies ended up here. But what about the circumstances that led there to being a much higher mortality rate?
Going to be the final report, they say.
Yeah, I mean, that's
what's left of the commission's
workload.
And
that's going to be massive, because they do say in the report, and I think that's really interesting, that this is given without historical context. They say that right at the beginning as a sort of a health warning, in a sense that this may read as brutal, because what we're literally doing is where were these bodies, where are they buried, what evidence do we have, and we're not giving historical context. We'll be doing that in the end, but they do actually give historical context, I think, incidentally, which is that this was a collective endeavour. You've got local communities looking the other way, you've got religious orders not keeping accurate records or not remembering, you've got county councils doing the same thing. People don't know where or how these babies were buried, and they didn't think at the time that it was worth recording, and that tells us a lot I think about ourselves.
Maybe analogous to all of that, we'll be talking about the teaching of history in secondary schools, and also some of the latest sporting conflicts off the pitch.
it's all
you this morning. Back with more from our panel in just a moment.
Salah takes the shot. Mo Salah with one of the goals of the season smashes a shot into the top corner of the net, and Liverpool are going back on top of the Premier League.
The people in the production booth have a phenomenal habit of not telling me when they're about to play commentary clips of classic Liverpool moments, which as a Manchester United fan I just have to grin and bear and hope that better times are ahead. That is Mo Salah scoring the second goal in Liverpool's very, very important win last weekend. Another really big day today in the title race in the Premier League. Liverpool will be on action live on Off the Ball later this afternoon, and we'll be talking about that a little more in the next hour. In the meantime, we're still going through today's Sunday papers with Mick Clifford, Lindsay Erna-Byrne and Richie Oakley. There's some pieces written, including an editorial in, I think, the Sunday Business Post today, Lindsay, about the teaching of history, which I presume that you as a historian would be very keen to stress. And then I saw your face sort of drop off air during the ad break when I mentioned that I would like to consider myself as something of a functional adult, and I did not do history for the junior cert. And I think it's possible to come through that.
I was very diplomatic when you said that. Of course it is. I think the question is what happens when generally people don't have to do it. So one or two people not doing it, we can basically compensate for you.
Thank you.
But if nobody does it, I think it's just, I do think more than ever, look at what's happening all around the world and look at how much history informs what is happening. I think the case is pretty easy to make at the moment. But also, there's the editorial in the Sunday Business Post, is it?
Yeah.
Is very good. But they mention, you know, while this paper obviously, is interested in the commercial side of things and encourages STEM disciplines, we also don't want that to happen at the expense of the humanities. And I think this is the problem, is that it's been seen as though there's some form of competition rather than the fact that having people literate and cognizant in both of these things is really important. But I think history also, in an era, I've really noticed a decrease in literacy. And I think having people do history and the reading it requires and the writing it requires means that you keep alive skills that are really, really being undermined at the moment. And you help people to express themselves better in written form, which is important. And that's definitely something that's under assault. Finally, last pitch is if you look at societies where history is not taught as a mandatory up to the level that we teach it in school, And you look at their total disconnection with their past. So let's just look at somewhere like England and the relationship.
Imagine that being the first example you found.
Well, it's so overwhelming in Brexit. If you look at the kind of this nostalgia for the empire and a complete whitewashing of what that might have involved, but also this kind of 1940s spirit that's infusing much of the debates, and this idea that somehow things were better in the past because people have airbrushed all of the other really nasty things that were happening in the 1940s, but also the reach of the empire. So obviously, hands up. It's in my interests because obviously you'd worry that if it falls off through the school level, it's also going to fall off a third level. And I think that would be a real pity because some of the research coming out of third level is informing loads of levels of policy and other issues. And journalists also, you can really see the amount of journalists who are, like you mentioned Conor O'Flaherty earlier, people who are really cognizant of their history and how they can use that for really top-notch analysis. Now you see, I have complimented all the journalists in the room. I expect support from the panel on this issue.
Thank you for complimenting the journalist who's sitting here presenting the programme, who of course did not study history for
You were a big maths person, so you're alien to me anyway.
I was a big maths person. I had a kind of a numbers thing. But Mick Clifford, the thing that strikes me sometimes, and of course I say this as someone who happens not to do history for junior leaving cert. And by the way, if people are wondering, the reason why is because the school timetable was structured that you either took history or geography, which I didn't take either, or you could take music. And I was obliged by virtue of me going to secondary school that I had to do music. And that was the reason why I didn't do it. So it is possible not to do it. But sometimes maybe the case could be made that not everyone would have to do history if those who were in the media or who were presenting the circumstances of the day's events to the public, at least if they were versed in history, then at least they could transmit their own understanding of that.
No, Gavin, I couldn't buy that. I mean, I studied it for the junior cert. I absolutely loved it, but I had ludicrous career notions at that stage that I wanted to be a civil engineer, which I ended
ludicrous.
Up being.
But well, from the salary,
for me,
that would
ludicrous.
Have brought.
Excuse me, it's not the. It's just me personally.
Yeah.
It turned out not to be a great fit. But the point I'm making is, I was advised to concentrate on science subjects.
Mick has previously said there's some bridges in the UK that he won't. he still won't go over.
Exactly, that I was involved. But anyway, the point I'm making is, I couldn't agree more with Lindsay. And I think the other element to it is, in an era when education is being underfunded, when there's talk of going more to industry to fund education, are we going to move away and regard education as primarily specific and direct preparation for the labour market effectively? And I think that would be a huge shame. And as Lindsay says as well, in the context of what's going on in the world at the moment, it has never been more important, I think. So I'd be completely against not having it compulsory for the junior cert.
Well, consider myself schooled, if you'll pardon the pun. Speaking of modern history, people might remember that it was remarked a couple of weeks ago that when John Delaney took over as the head of the FAI, one of the things he was complaining about at the time was the personal expenses built up by one of his predecessors on the company's credit cards. But the John Delaney saga rolls on. Richie, it's in the Sunday counterpart to your daily paper, and reporting this morning that €60,000 in inverted commas professional fees it was paid to Susan Keegan in 2013 and 14, who at the time was the chief executive's girlfriend. She reports, though, later in the paper, and it's insisted by those who are close to her, that she never received any money from the FAI.
Yeah, a bit of a mystery here. I mean, obviously, Mark has seen some kind of Mark Tighe and Paul Rowan in the Sunday Times have obviously seen some of the records that show a total of 60,000 professional fees going through the FAI's system for Susan Keegan, and they have emails and things referencing the payment, and then strangely enough she's saying she never received any payment. So there's a Mazars report obviously into the FAI, and this is going to be part of their terms of reference, and if I was in the FAI I would be wanting to hurry this report up before Mark Tighe just writes it for them through the front pages of the Sunday Times.
Or they could get their money just by rehashing all of his reports.
Well, there is an argument sometimes, I think, when the state spend multiples of thousands on reports, I often look at it and go, if they just open the file, I'll go in as a journalist and get it done the weekend for you. Yeah, and I'll do it for free. Mm. And I'll write it up much more entertainingly as well. But yeah, obviously, like, this has been going on now. And, you know, the key thing here is just a lack of transparency, a lack of accountability, and a lack of what appears to be following set procedures. And obviously Sport Ireland at this stage have drawn a line in the sand saying, you know, this has to be resolved or you're not going to be getting your state funding. I'd imagine that Mazars report is going to make for very interesting reading. And it's a wonder that the FAI board is still there. It's a wonder that they have allowed John Delaney to kind of dictate the terms of his stepping aside as well.
The thing that strikes me about all of this is that this again will fall under the terms of reference of Mazars, and John Tracy, the CEO of Sport Ireland, confirmed that in the Oireachtas Committee during the week. He said that any third party payments would fall within the terms of reference for the Mazars investigation. But that's Mazars who were hired by the FAI themselves. They're not necessarily acting on Sport Ireland's instruction, because the FAI decided themselves to volunteer for that review by Mazars. So they are allowing themselves to somewhat set the parameters of that investigation. Just to recap some of the details, by the way, because there can be a little bit of perhaps misunderstanding for people who are listening to us and who haven't read the full piece by Mark Tighe and Paul Rowan in this morning's paper. They say the Sunday Times has seen an email sent by John Delaney to the FAI's finance department on February the 3rd, 2014. Under the subject 15K Susan Keegan, Delaney asked, can you transfer 15K to the account? It's agreed with Michael Cody, who was another member of the board, and Eddie Murray, who was the treasurer at the time, as an overall payment of 50K. Cody and Murray were both directors of the FAI. The FAI's internal accounts then show a payment of 15K recorded in the name of Keegan 3 days later on February the 6th. In total, the FAI noted at least three payments in the name of Keegan, totally €16,000. The address recorded for Keegan on the FAI accounts was in Kent, England. Stephanie Howard, Keegan's sister, now lives at that address with her husband. On Friday, Howard said, I spoke to my sister last night and she confirmed that she received no payment from John Delaney or the FAI. Keegan is now said to be living in Spain, and according to her sister, does not wish to comment further. Keegan was in a relationship with Delaney for several years. All contact with Delaney is said to have been cut when her relationship ended.
If your mother's there, confusing. I mean, the easiest thing you'd be asking is, can we see the account number and then trace back where that account was and you know, who had...
Or who's the beneficial owner of it and all that.
Account. It's easy enough.
Mick, you've been chomping at the bit for long enough, so I'm finally going to let you off the leash. One of your county's footballing heroes, Pat Spillane, being dragged through the mud in several of today's broadsheet newspapers by the Minister for Rural and Community Affairs, Michael Ring, who was criticised by a man, albeit on the Late Late Show. It's a pretty high profile platform from which you can criticise someone. And this morning wants to know exactly how much RT you've paid him.
Nobody.
Why?
Nobody who has 8 All-Ireland medals should be dragged through the mud for anything, as far as I'm concerned.
No, diplomatic immunity.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. No, yeah, I think Pat, he went gung-ho on Friday night. Look, it seems to be, first of all, I think Michael Ring, as a minister, demanding that a private citizen reveal what he's getting paid in a salary, I think there's something a bit outrageous about that. But quite obviously, Mickey Ring has been set off by Pat's performance on The Late Late Show. Look, it's one of two, and he's also released some texts which he suggests where Pat is looking to be reappointed as this ambassador. It's one of two things. Either, and Michael Ring presumably would make the case that Pat is bitter because he was not reappointed to a job he wanted to make, or presumably...
But might there not be some merit to that, though? The idea that Pat Spillane had this role which expired last Christmas and he would quite like for that role to be reformed and to keep it on.
And an alternative way of looking at it, Gavin, is that Pat Spillane has been let off the leash because he no longer is in that role and he's pointing out some home truth. It should be said two things about it, and I've written a lot about rural Ireland in recent years. One... I think there's no doubt it has not been well served by the government. But two, neither has it been well served by local politicians who continually concentrate on the short term and the quick fix and emotional reaction to anything they raise, like, for example, in terms of drink driving laws, that rather than concentrating on the long term and how best to manage what to some extent is inevitable decline. But if it's managed in a proper way, then you can make the most for rural Ireland in that regard.
The one thing that I find curious about it, Richie, is that Michael Ring, at least in the Sunday Times one, which is the one that I have in front of me, whether he did or not, it doesn't appear in the interview that he did with Stephen O'Brien, but he doesn't appear to have actually entertained any substantive points that Pat Spillane might have been making. It's all really about the process and not necessarily about the substance.
Well, he's going for the man here, and not quite the ball.
It's a bit of a heavy shoulder.
If I'm someone in rural Ireland and you're looking at this, you'd be it's like two bald fellas arguing over a comb. You know, like people in rural Ireland are well capable of helping themselves. And what they need is certainty, and they need decisions, and they need investment going into particular areas, and I'm sure they'd be much more interested in finding out from Michael Ring where the government stands on the national broadband plan, as opposed to what his feelings are about whether or not he was unfairly maligned by Pat Spillane, the Late Late Show.
Lindsay, Michael Ring makes a point in his interview with Stephen O'Brien of the Sunday Times. He says yesterday, how can one man, and he's talking about Spillane in this case, how can one man say that I'm doing a great job in February and then I'm not doing it right in April? There were never as many people working or living in rural Ireland. We have some fantastic projects underway right around the country, and as Pat Spillane told the media repeatedly in the last several months, rural Ireland is not dead, it's fighting back strongly. On Mick's point about how people can suddenly, when they're off the leash, that they're suddenly liable to say all sorts of critical things, does it ever strike you as someone who's outside of the media or political worlds that so many people seem to keep their criticisms under their hats when it's convenient, when they're inside, when in fact if they raised their concerns inside the tent when they had the opportunity to do so, maybe we might get somewhere?
Oh yeah, well, I mean, that's obviously something you can level there for sure, but I don't think that it was a very ministerial response to it either. I mean showing the text, I think that's a bit,
it's certainly bizarre. You should have gone to demand
the substance only, actually,
that a separate employer would release his details of a salary. And also, by the way, went to another one of the papers and revealed how much Pat Spillane was paid for that role and all the expenses that he got for it.
And the other thing is he's announced that there's going to be some sort of a rural roadshow to show the people of rural Ireland what exactly is being done for them. I mean, that takes the biscuits.
That's a roadshow with those local link buses, I presume.
Exactly, yeah. Going around, look at all we've done for you. Be happy, vote for us.
Listeners are very exercised by the issue of history teaching, it seems. As you talk about history, Lindsay said Brexit was about nostalgia for the 1940s. It was mainly about immigration, which seems to be ignored. And Kevin says, distorted, propagandised teaching of history has blighted this country and caused countless deaths and untold misery during the last 100 years.
Well, not in my class, but in terms of Brexit being about immigration, the whole point is that's been linked to the idea that there was once a time when there wasn't immigration and Britain was better, etc., etc. So that immigration, the anti-immigration stuff, is stitched into a false historical narrative. So it's not that it's being ignored.
As a news editor, up until recently, I had a lot of very young people in the newsroom, and then we brought in Lise Hand into the newsroom.
Actually, Lise would very strongly dissent with the idea of her not being a young
woman. But the thing is, I sometimes find myself saying to people, "Do you remember such and such?" Because it's come around again, and I'm trying to explain it to them. And I'm saying, "Do you remember such and such?" Because this has the relevance today, and what you're going to see is a repeated pattern of that, and that's why you need to go after the story in this way. And Lise will turn around and say, "I was there during that. I was at that concert. I was at that gig. I remember that political incident." And you can't buy that, but you can teach it. And I did history at third level, and I gave it up after the first year because I thought philosophy was cooler and there was way more jobs prospects for philosophers. this is a way to get a job out of this arts degree. And I'm sorry I did, and I think I'd love to go back and do it again because I see it now. I'm old enough now that I remember some of the things, say, in the state papers. I have a vague recollection of stuff in the state papers, and you have a much better understanding of things. And I find myself trying to convince young journalists now to go back, say, and read books like The Power Game by Stephen Collins about like early Fianna Fáil. I'm always telling them to read The Boss, the book about Charlie Hottie, because it's this. If you understand that, then you kind of understand where Fianna Fáil are now. If you understand Fine Gael's past, you understand where Fine Gael are now. But not only that, as journalists, you understand what they're likely to do next, and that's the key thing.
We will have you back to philosophize some other point about the merits of all those other humanities learnings. I'm afraid
we'll recruit you to the call.
I'm afraid we're going to have to do it some other time because we're completely out of time for now. My thanks to all of you for coming in this morning. It's been a great chat. Mick Clifford is author and special correspondent with the Irish Examiner. Richie Oakley is the editor of the Ireland edition of The Times. And Lindsay Erna Byrne is an author and historian. Thank you all very much for joining me this morning.